This recording is being conducted for the Evaluative Techniques class in the Early Childhood Education program. The material that the instructor will use is from the book called Early Childhood Education, An Individualized Approach to Developmental Instruction by David L. Lilly, a brand new text on this area. I am the instructor. My name is Shirley Newton. And today I want to quote from this book because I feel that this is very relevant to our study on assessment in this course, and particularly as it applies to the preschool child. I shall begin reading on page 29 of the book, on the chapter 3, entitled Assessing Children. Child assessment activities aid the teacher or daycare worker in determining the appropriate instructional objectives for his or her children. Therefore, we believe that the teacher should play a vital part in the assessment process. It is common practice for psychologists, guidance counselors, and others with professional training in testing and measurement to administer various forms of standardized tests to school children. Assessment information from such tests has been used to establish homogeneous grouping by intellectual or academic ability. It has also been used to provide the teacher with more insight about the child, with the anticipation that this will enable him or her to identify instructional activities for that child. Unfortunately, the value of using test results in this manner is becoming more and more questionable. Much of the testing children undergo today has little relevance to their educational needs because of both the manner in which the testing is conducted and the manner in which the results are used. Many diagnostic procedures currently employed continue to emphasize as their goal an etiological or clinical symptom classification, which enables the school or community system to group the child with other children who have been similarly classified as needing a particular kind of treatment or training. This practice widely persists in the face of increasing evidence that homogeneous grouping by intellectual ability has little relevance to the educational progress or needs of the children. For example, low-ability children grouped homogeneously in special classes on the basis of traditional diagnostic classifications progress educationally at a slower rate than low-ability children remaining in regular grade placements. If assessment for instructional purposes is to be meaningful, you as the teacher must be involved in the assessment process. Actually, teachers are involved in observing and assessing children every day. Although the chances are that the techniques used are quite subjective and non-systematic, the teacher is familiar with the educational facilities at her disposal, the environment in which learning is to take place, the materials available, and more important, her own teaching strengths and weaknesses. The psychologist or counselor who comes from outside the classroom has to assess in a relative vacuum and therefore has a difficult time relating the recommendations he makes on the basis of test results to the environment in which the child is expected to learn. The main departure in the assessment procedure used in our developmental task instructional system from the usual procedures is our emphasis on determining specific developmental objectives. Most available assessment devices provide information that is only marginally related to the task-based developmental information needed to establish meaningful instructional objectives. There is no one developmental scale that can provide a composite profile of the abilities we outlined earlier: gross motor skills, fine motor skills, perceptual skills, reasoning skills and processes, receptive language skills, and expressive language skills. To compensate for this lack, Many workers use subtests from a variety of scales and tests. The annotated test bibliography at the end of this chapter provides a list of scales which have been developed to measure various developmental abilities. Although we regard assessment as part of the total instructional system process, we must mention here that a recent trend in education has caused many to take a critical look at established measurement procedures at the preschool level. The public, and in turn the federal government, has become increasingly concerned about the failure of educators and other child workers to demonstrate the effectiveness of their procedures. As a result, federal and state governments now expect recipients of large sums of public funds to show that these funds have been efficiently used. This demand has fostered a frenzied search for effective assessment instruments and evaluation techniques. Many workers in education confuse the process of assessment with the process of evaluation. Assessment, as we are using the term here, refers to the process of determining the child's strengths and weaknesses in specific areas of behavior. Evaluation refers to the process of determining how successful a teacher or an instructional program was in accomplishing a set of goals or objectives. For example, if you, as a project director or a principal of a school, establish three main program objectives for the year, your evaluation plan should be designed so that you can determine whether or not you met those objectives. The need for establishing evaluation procedures for the Head Start program led to the development of an assessment instrument called the Preschool Inventory by Caldwell in 1967. Now, Caldwell's task was to create an instrument that could assess the changes that took place in children as a result of intervention. Because of a lack of curriculum development guidance in many of the Head Start classes, some Head Start teachers used the preschool inventory as a base or a curriculum guide for their curriculum activities. Although many psychologists and educators frowned upon this practice, suggesting that the teachers were teaching for the test, this use of the preschool inventory can be considered an early application of a criterion reference testing program. Now, let's go on to talk about criterion reference measurements. Criterion reference measurement is a concept articulated by Glasser in 1963 in an effort to develop a more relevant use of educational testing. A criterion reference measurement is constructed to yield scores that are directly interpretable in terms of a specific standard of performance. This performance standard could also be viewed as a desired outcome of an instructional objective. The criterion reference measure is different from a normative reference test, the type of measure that most people think of when the word test is mentioned. A normative reference test compares the child taking the test with the hundreds or thousands of children on whom the test was standardized. Its purpose is to determine the relative standing of the child. Normative reference tests, however, often do not provide the kind of information needed to make intelligent instructional decisions. In fact, the information derived from a normative reference test may often impede the development of good educational strategies. For example, when a teacher uses the results of an IQ test to determine where a child stands in language development or reading skills, his or her resultant decisions on instructional activities for that child will be based on faulty assumptions. We advocate, therefore, the use of a criterion referenced approach for child assessment for two main reasons. First reason is to provide assistance to the teacher in developing specific instructional objectives for each child in her program. As you begin the year, you can use the results of this type of assessment to establish a point of entry into the instructional system cycle. The second reason for using a criterion-referenced approach is to provide some means for evaluating the effectiveness of the instructional activities used in reaching your instructional objectives. Many educators argue that failure to learn, in most cases, demonstrates the limitations, not of the learner, but of the instructional activities used to help him learn. To meet the need for a criterion-referenced measurement of developmental tasks in the primary mental abilities area, we developed the Carolina Developmental Profile. The profile should not be considered a test, for it was not designed as one. Rather, it was designed and developed to help assess the abilities of young children from 2 to 5 in the following developmental areas: gross motor skills, fine motor skills, visual perception skills, reasoning processes, receptive language skills, and expressive language skills. The items on the profile are similar to standardized items that can be found in a number of different developmental scales. Their inclusion in the profile was based on several criteria. Number one, they are relevant to developmental and early education instruction. Number two, they are easy to administer. And three, they are precise and easy to measure, rather than vague and difficult to measure, or can be measured only by subjective criteria. When we are assessing children ages 5 to 6, there are some people with whom we should become familiar. We have learned, or I have learned, that the pioneering work of L.L. Thurston and Thelma Gwynne Thurston produced the primary mental abilities theory, which in turn provided a basic part of the rationale for the developmental task instructional system. The late Professor L.L. Thurston was one of America's leading specialists in psychological measurement. His book, Multiple Factor Analysis, written in 1947, is a scientific explanation of the mathematical analysis and research techniques underlying the primary mental abilities theory. We have successfully used the primary mental abilities K-1 test, written by Thurston in 1963, to provide developmental profiles for 5- and 6-year-old children. Although the test does provide a measure of or for overall intellectual level, it also gives individual scores for the various primary mental ability levels. Therefore, the PMA test makes an excellent assessment instrument for 5- and 6-year-olds. The 5 primary mental abilities measured by these tests are, briefly, verbal meaning, the ability to understand ideas expressed in words. In later school years, this is the most important single index of a child's academic potential. Then there's number facility, the ability to work with numbers, to handle simple quantitative problems rapidly and accurately, and to understand and recognize quantitative differences. At the lower grade levels, number facility scores are determined by a pictorial test that requires no reading. Addition problems are also used. Arithmetical reasoning problems are substituted at the upper levels. Then there's the area, the mental ability of reasoning, the ability to solve logical problems. Separate measures of this ability are not provided in the batteries designed for grades K-4. In the 4-6 battery, it is measured by word grouping, letter series, and number series tests. Then there's the area of perceptual speed, the ability to recognize likeness and differences between objects or symbols quickly and accurately. This ability is important in acquiring reading skills, but tends to plateau at a relatively early age. Then there's the area of spatial relations. The ability to visualize objects and figures rotated in space and the relations between them. The test measuring this ability appears at every level of the PMA and is important throughout the school years. Now, the five primary mental abilities measured in the PMA test are not all-inclusive. Many more factors have been isolated through research, nor are all abilities equally important at all ages. Their relative importance shifts with age. The importance of verbal meaning, for instance, increases as a child advances through school, whereas perceptual speed becomes relatively less and less important. A number of other tests are available to use with young children. Your criteria for selecting these tests should be based on how useful they are in assisting you in establishing objectives for your particular group of children. Many teachers devise their own series of assessment checklists, either to replace or to supplement information from more formal measures. This is often a desirable practice, especially for experienced teachers who have developed program goals that reflect the special character of the children in their program, the kind of home and community they come from, and their own philosophy of early education. Before you can devise your own observational checklist, you must have a clear understanding of your long-range objectives. What should most children in your program be able to accomplish by the end of the year? Do you want them to be able to count to 10? Do you want them to be able to play cooperatively for long periods during the day? Spell out these objectives in clear, precise statements, enabling you or others to tell by observing the child if that objective has been met. These items can be placed in a simple sequence on a page, much like the items in the Carolina Developmental Profile booklet. How often should you use the checklist to review the abilities of your children? Practices vary. Some teachers use a checklist daily, others once every week or two. This is the end of the contribution from the book, and I feel that this can be very meaningful, and I trust that this has been enlightening to you, and I think that if you have any further question, I would be just more than happy to put this textbook on reserve in the library so that you could read it and go over it again for your own edification and benefit. We continue with curriculum relationships. We discussed yesterday curriculum relationships for the 3 to 4-year-old, and you have your notes. Now today we're going to discuss curriculum relationships for the 4 to 5-year-old, because this is, and then on to the 5 to 6-year-old, because these are important when you're writing curriculum. You have to have a good hold on child development principles when you're writing curriculum, so that you know what to write for, what needs are to be met. Okay, we talked about the child from 5 to 6 years of age, how he was beginning to do a lot. No, we didn't. We haven't got that far yet. I'm sorry. It's 4 to 5 years of age. Let me correct myself. Okay, we were talking about the child from 4 to 5 years of age, how that he is able to do a lot of things that he was never able to do before. And we should provide for him a great variety of experiences. And I think we talked about cooking, preparing salads, making bread, and that kind of thing that he could do. Baking and cooking ideas were real good for him. And also we said that he could do simple classification tasks. Not working with chemicals, but classifying, for example, buttons, wooden pegs, crayons, pencils, tongue depressors, popsicle sticks. In other words, he learns to classify and differentiate. He learns to put things into categories in terms of size, shape, color,
and counts them as well. Now, one area of the curriculum that we are concentrating on today for planning for 4 to 5 year olds, for example, and this can be expanded also for 5 to 6 year olds, is science for young children. And I have given you a handout telling you just what kinds of activities, developmental activities in science, are prescribed for young children. And I have put them down here so that when you write your curriculum, you can mention some of these things, and these will give you guidelines to writing a science curriculum for a 4-year-old or a 5-year-old. First of all, we recommend that you let the children observe a lot around them, observe objects and phenomena. What do we mean by phenomena? Those are elements of phenomena. Phenomena has scientific meanings, something that has to be understood by means of science.
I think phenomena is also defined as things which cannot be totally defined or understood. Like UFOs are considered phenomena.
Right. Okay. So, observing things around them, like earth, trees, flowers, animals, water, weather, and so on. And then we go on to providing them with objects so that they can understand some of the things that are around them, like magnets, metallic objects, smell board, touch board, skeletal structures of animals in the science corner, real animals in cages or bottles or terrariums, fish in a fish tank, potted plants, and so on. And you should keep these learning materials at a simple level so that interest may be maintained. Now, we say, let them observe. Sure. Why do we encourage young children to observe? We encourage them to observe so that they can make discoveries. Because they're explorers. That's what they really are. Okay, another way that we can provide good scientific activities to interest them is to bring specialists into the classroom to increase their interest in a particular thing. For example, if the unit that you're exposing them to is, for example, space, and you have a demonstration of a space capsule and the kids have been making their own rockets, you know, they can make their own simple rockets and things of this nature. You might bring somebody in who works in the aerospace industry who could help them to show them different models of planes and rockets and satellites and all this kind of thing, and have them just to talk to them about it, and not to give a lecture, of course, but just to talk to them about it, let them handle the different objects that he has brought and this kind of thing. Yes. Sure. Field trips. Put that down as number 5, field trips. And then, of course, 3, the teacher finds things that the child is able to master and assists him with his own progress. For example, a magnet, a child is able to handle a magnet with nails and bobby pins and all that kind of stuff. And he gets a lot of pleasure out of doing it to see what happens. And he makes his own deductions from what he experiences. Then she provides him with experiences that are satisfying. In other words, I remember when I was in the science lab, I was in elementary education, I was doing science projects for our first and second graders. And what I did was I brought in a scale, and we brought in a lot of stuff to put on the scale to weigh and to see, show the children what balance is, and to let them understand that you have to put the same amount of whatever you put on both sides of the scale, or you get an imbalance, you know. And they talk about it, and they watch it. They have a sack of peas or popcorn or something else, and they dole it out and put it on both sides. And you should see the fun that they have putting the popcorn here and here until the scale is balanced, and until you have just as much here. But then when they put a lot of popcorn here, then this one rides up, and they watch that, and they figure that they've got less because it rode up on that side, and they've got more because it weighed down on this side and held the other side up, and it's really interesting for them to work with things like that. And that's a very simple procedure. A scale is a very good object, as well as a magnet, to have in the classroom. Now, you can make makeshift scales for children. They can make their own scales, but they need to get the idea of weight and mass, volume. And they get that basic idea, and they find out also, they get a chance to look at different shaped jars. And you put the same amount in two jars, but they're different shapes, and then they pour them back and forth and everything, and they get ideas about mass, weight, and volume. And this is important to start them out this way. Very simple exercises, but they teach them basic fundamentals of science. Okay, then four, what are the desirable attitudes? There are eight of them that should be encouraged in the pupil. We want to encourage their curiosity, their rationality, their objectivity, their suspended judgment, critical-mindedness, open-mindedness, honesty, and humility. All of these can be encouraged as the pupil goes through his science classes. Okay. Science does satisfy and stimulate children's curiosity. You say, a lot of people would say, well, you mean to tell me that you can introduce science in the curriculum to a preschooler? Why, of course, if you do it right. If you keep in mind that he's only three or four years of age, and that he can only understand certain things, and that he is not an abstract thinker, but you're simply trying to get across to him concepts and generalizations. And this is the pre-reasoning age. A three-year-old, a four-year-old, a five-year-old, he doesn't reason. A five-year-old may do some reasoning as a result of what he sees happening. But a three- and a four-year-old will not do too much reasoning. They will do a lot of observing, and the reasoning will come later because of observations. And this is scientific. And then also you should give a child, if he's three or four or five, an opportunity to attack a problem from several different aspects. In other words, let the children know that there is more than one way to solve any problem. There's an old proverb. I don't know whether it's a proverb or not. I guess it's a proverb. Have you ever heard of this? There's more than one way to skin a cat? Well, that can apply to problems. There's more than one way to attack a problem. How many of you have been aware at one time or another that your roommate or your friend had the same problem you did and had a different approach, a different way of attacking the problem and solving it, and yet the same result was arrived at? Sometimes. Not always. Sometimes some people get better results because of the different approach to a problem. But anyway, here's a little poem that goes along. Red, green, yellow, a color spectrum view, seashells, sky, rivers, and mountains. How does one study these things? When I am in school and I want to know, what will my teacher say? Will she say, yes, I will help you find your answers, or will she turn me away? Don't give children answers, but help them find them. Children can spend lots of time just working, observing. Children need to know causes and effects of events, natural or otherwise. They want to know why you have a hurricane, why there was a tornado, why there was an earthquake, why there was a flood. What are the natural effects of weather? And why do we have land erosion and this kind of thing? They can arrive at some of the simple answers when they are very young. Because we have such a great body of knowledge today, it's important that children learn how to find answers on their own. We're not going to just provide for them in a curriculum a certain body of knowledge. We're going to help them turn the key to open the door to the world of knowledge. because each child will have his own background of knowledge. Many of them will have different types of knowledge, but that doesn't mean that it need conflict. Each child should be stimulated to find out his own answers to why things are the way they are. Okay, when you give a child this opportunity to observe and to write down or to tell of what he has discovered and to collect data and to see life as it really is, what you are engendering is clear thinking, logic, and dissatisfaction with unanswered questions. This is what you're causing a child to want to do, is to think clearly for himself and to arrive at some sort of system of logic, reason, and to be dissatisfied with unanswered questions. When children are dissatisfied with unanswered questions, it means that they're bored. A child needs to be interested in everything, and he will be interested in things if you give him the opportunity. Now, some of the things that children need to learn are these. I want you to write them down. Children need to learn. This is through science. Children need to learn how to classify objects. Okay, is it an animal? Is it a fish? Is it a flower? What is it? Children need to learn to classify objects. Comma. They need to note the similarities among them. They need to note the similarities among them. That's one thing that will come out of goals for science. These really are your goals for science. If you want to put that at the top, children need to learn goals for science. That's what they are, actually. So when you write your goals for your curriculum for science, these could be some of them. But you would have to be more specific. Second goal would be children need to identify characteristics of objects and name them, such as something is hard, soft, dissolvable, soluble, liquid, and so forth. Children need to identify characteristics of objects. This should be one of the goals of any scientific activity, these first two. Identifying characteristics. Oh, that's salt. That must be salt. It tastes salty. Yeah, and it looks like salt, and it feels like salt. So I would say that identifies it as salt because it tastes salty, and it looks like salt, and it's white. Identifying characteristics. Very important. Okay, another goal for science activities is that children need to note the processes that occur. In the case of one object changing from one form to another, like melting ice, hardening liquid, children need to note the processes that occur. In the case of one object changing from one form to another. All right, another goal for scientific activity is that children need to learn to recognize cause and effect. What made that happen? How does that affect me? Cause and effect. Okay, another goal for scientific activities in the curriculum would be children need to identify different odors or smells that are significant. Children need to identify different odors or smells, like the smell of vinegar as opposed to the smell of cider. Another goal would be children need to recognize differences in sizes. Differences in shapes, color, etc. Another goal would be children need to recognize how absorbency works as a process in a sponge or a sheet of blotting paper. It's a fantastic thing to a child for mother to bring along the big sponge where there was a spill of water or milk, and all of a sudden, it's gone. Where is it? It went up into the sponge. How did the sponge do that? And will it come back out again if I squeeze it? Well, try it. Sure. There it is back out again. So the milk or the water, whatever it was, didn't change form. It was just absorbed. One of the goals was to recognize how absorbency works. Example, sponge. That's another goal. Now here's another goal. Children need to know how electricity works. Do you think a preschooler can make any discoveries about how electricity works? What would be some of the discoveries a preschooler could make about how electricity works? He wouldn't be so apt to do that.
No, but I'm talking about, see, there's a game we used to play at home.
But we're talking about preschoolers.
Yeah, but preschoolers would be tempting. I'm we had some little kids there too. This is when I was younger. This is not when I was.
But I mean, in his immediate environment, a preschooler would learn what about electricity right in his immediate environment?
Well,
the light. Sure.
Because the light operates, that's the power.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What governs the power of that light?
The switch.
The switch.
But they'll still wonder, how did that switch get that light on? And you have to explain, well, there's wires.
Well, if he happens to be in a place where they're building a house, he might see all of that going on.
If you know, Brenda's building, show
them how he's doing. What would be something, for example, there are lots of electrical appliances. And I mean, it would seem to me that that would be one of the easiest things to explain to a child. Because when you plug in the iron, you get what?
Heat.
What about the stove? Many ranges are operated by electricity. It would seem one of the neatest things to me. And I think that every child ought to see the old-fashioned electric light bulb. Because we have all kinds of different examples of how light can come into a room. And all of the fixtures are not the same. And I think that a child ought to see an old-fashioned light bulb and understand about the tungsten and so on that's inside that lights up. I think that that's really fascinating. Of course, why I think that's so wonderful is because my daddy was an electrician. And I just had an edge on that all the way along. Okay, not that I know a whole lot about it, but I know a lot more than a lot of gals do. Okay. Children also need to know how simple machines work, such as a pump, a lawnmower, a lever, a pulley. For example, what would be a good thing to bring into the classroom in the way of a pump? A bicycle pump? Okay. What about a pulley, fellas? What kind of a pulley could you bring to the classroom to let preschoolers fool around with? Just a simple pulley. Yeah. Yeah, like one that operates a pump in a well, in a fresh water well, you know.
The exercise ropes that they have now.
Have pulleys on them.
Yeah.
That's right.
That's a
simple. That'd be a simple illustration. Yeah. Out of an erector set. How many of you, did you fellows have an erector set when you were younger? Did you? We had one at our house, too. I fooled around with it. Tinker toys, too, mm-hmm. And we have that. Okay. Children need to know how weights offset each other as the balance weights on a scale, and I already told you about that. That would be one of the goals. And the seesaw, the principle of the seesaw. Children need to know how weights offset each other, as in the balance weights on a scale, or a seesaw. They also need to learn how a fire may be caused by careless behavior. Does every preschooler know who Smokey the Bear is? Yeah, but they should. You know, they've seen him enough on TV to know who Smokey the Bear is. Or Hootie the Owl. He's the one that's current, isn't he? Isn't Hootie the Owl the replacement for Smokey the Bear? Anyway, they need to know how a fire gets started because of careless behavior. Yes. Yes. All right. I will turn it off. One now with one more goal a couple of more goals that we have for scientific activities. Children need to know how scientific information is acquired. In other words, the process of obtaining data. Data is truth. Data is information. They need to know how this information is acquired, mostly by observation and experience, deductive reasoning, and so on. Okay? Then children need to learn that scientific information is checked out and verified by many, many people. This would give a child a great deal of confidence in the fact that people are not just messing around with things and then telling you that this is the way it is without really checking it out thoroughly and saying, well, it has proved to be true in this case, in this case, in this case, so this is so. In other words, they have tried it and tested it. That's very satisfying and also provides security in many cases. Okay, children need to learn also what is considered fact one day may be disproved and changed another day, all depending on the progress that science makes in fact-finding. Children need to learn that what is considered fact one day may be disproved and changed another day, so that as science progresses. And science has made a great deal of progress. You'll have to admit that. In the last 25 to 40 years, there's been a great deal of progress made. Now, kids in the 4 to 5 year old bracket are learning science through opportunities with materials that are safe for them to use. Don't ever provide anything for a child that is not safe for him to use. Then, of course, in the primary grades, the activities can be a little more complicated. But children who are preschoolers may be able to use a magnifying glass. They can be taught this. They can be taught how to use a compass. They can be taught the advantages of being able to use a magnet in some cases and things that have magnets in them. They can be taught how to plant flowers. Of course, children in the preschool age, until they're able to really write, they can't put down data. But they can have a lot of things going on in their heads, you know. And they can, when they continually experience these things, they'll begin to make association between one thing and another, so that after a while they'll know exactly what sugar is like and the characteristics that sugar has that salt does not have. They'll be able to distinguish between the two, and they'll be able to distinguish between things that are bitter and things that are sweet, and so on and so forth. And I think it's important to care to help a child to be able to put adjectives to what he observes, because it helps him to build his vocabulary as well. And then you can have lots of bottles around, providing they're not too dangerous should they get broken. Plastic bottles are very good to work with preschoolers, and let them put different quantities of things in the bottles and let them observe. You know, hitherto, a lot of people didn't think that children could learn anything scientific before, 10, 12, 14 years of age. Maybe. But children learn a lot of scientific principles in the raw when they're little. And this stimulates them, I think, this would stimulate a child toward taking a course in science later on, because he already knows some of the fundamentals and he's not that ignorant about what goes on in the scientific field. And it would help a child to really enjoy life. I just don't think there's anything like characteristic or the ability in a child to inquire and to want to inquire and be curious about what goes on around him or her. It's important to develop inquiry. All of us should be inquiring. I would hate to think that any of us get to the place where we don't continually ask questions and look things up and want to know. This is education, inquiry, really. All education is based on the idea of inquiry and curiosity, and particularly in the area of research. Now, what if Dr. Salk had never asked any questions about polio? Today we would not have Salk vaccine. What if Albert Einstein had never asked any questions about relativity? We wouldn't have what we have today as a body of science. We wouldn't have the atom bomb. What if Sir Isaac Newton hadn't discovered or observed that there is such a force as gravity? There are a lot of things that we wouldn't know. Principles to do with flying. that are so important as far as gravitational ability is concerned, and aerospace dynamics and all this kind of thing. So what if people had never asked questions? We wouldn't be where we are today, and that doesn't mean that we have arrived by any means, and we're still asking questions. We all need to ask questions. And I would encourage you with this statement that don't accept anything as fact without wondering about it first. I don't think that we ought just to have pat answers even in religious respects. We ought to ask questions, and we ought to strive to get answers, because that is a characteristic of intelligence. Anybody who accepts things as they seem to be passed across to him and never wonders never really gets anywhere. You should ask questions all the time. Maybe the instructors don't have all the answers to the questions. I'm sure they don't. But still, when you can't get it from an instructor, you should make a little private inquiry on your own. Because what's to say that you can't be smarter than your instructors? Don't be too bold in making statements like that. Because we don't always know whereof we speak. You have to be careful when you say you already are. You can't. That isn't a very good generalization. A lot of people think they are smarter than their instructors, you mean? Oh, I see what you mean. I didn't get that at all from it. Okay. That's a little different than what I thought you said. Okay. But you don't know who that child is that is in your classroom, 3, 4, or 5. He may be another Albert Einstein. He may be another Isaac Newton. He may be another Lindbergh. He may be another Admiral Byrd. You just never know. You could have lived 1,000 years and not said that. Oh, God forbid that you should have an Adolf Hitler in your classroom. If you've got a Christian classroom, he won't stay.
Amen.
Anyhow.
You know when they said it one time, that this person who led in China, and now is communism in the country, the reason it happened is because he went to see this evangelist, this Christian.
Mao Zedong.
He wanted to see evangelists, and people went there.
He was turned away because he was Chinese. He was discriminated against, and it wasn't by an American.
Well, the way you guys said it, it sounded like it was a Christian.
It was a man who was just supposed to be a Christian.
Yeah, but the way you said it, it's that, and the way you guys said it after, it's about the United States.
Well, the man wanted to see somebody who was an American, and this other man kept him from doing that. But the man who kept him from doing it was not an American.
So, in other words, he didn't actually realize it. Maybe it wasn't because of the American Christian.
It was because this Christian acted that way and turned him against Christianity. Okay, today is Thursday, and we've made some advances with curriculum. Now I hope that tomorrow we can just go on and do something with math activities. We'll try. And I'm giving you all of this. Let me say this before we dismiss. I'm giving you all of this so you'll have some background so that when I say, all right, now, write your own curriculum. You can pick out you've got enough material to pick out your activities and to help you and to do your research, because you'll have enough handouts and so on, and you'll have enough information so that you ought to be able to do an awfully good job on curriculum. I anticipate this. Okay. We'll find out how good it is when we finish with the course.
We'll see you.